First of all, I'd like to apologize to the to counsel and the parties in this matter for not being in Carson City, although I'm here at the Regional Justice Center. I'm recovering from some minor surgery, and I'm doing okay. My disclosure is that my son, David Cherry, adult child, is the Director of Communications for Congresswoman Shelley Berkley, and I thought important to disclose that. I'm sure many of you know that already, but I wanted to disclose that and see if there's any problem with me hearing this case. I don't feel that I'm prejudiced one way or the other as to one side or the other in this matter. Still have an open mind completely.
With that having been said, anyone else need to make any disclosures this morning? Hearing none, now either counsel wish to comment as to Justice Cherry's disclosure?
We have no comment, Your Honor. We accept the disclosure.
Thank you.
No comment, Your Honor.
This is the Democratic Party, Ross Miller, as appellants. They have the first opportunity. Please state for the record who you are when speaking, time you wish to reserve, or how you wish to split your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I will also be splitting my time with Mr. Elias for the interveners. May it please the court, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the appellant Ross Miller, Secretary of State. The House of Representatives is the people's house. When a vacancy occurs, the U.S. Constitution does not permit the governor of the state to appoint a replacement. Therefore, the entire purpose of holding a special election is so that the people of the district can elect somebody to represent them in Congress. In this case, the district court's decision deprives those voters of any meaningful choice into who their representative will ultimately be by giving all that power to the Central Committee of the parties to choose who will and who will not appear on the ballot.
Council, let me ask you a quick question in the interest of time. In 1954, we had a somewhat similar situation, maybe, when Senator McCarran died on September 27th after the primary, even though it was an uncontested Republican and Democratic primary, and we held that the State Central Committee could appoint the nominee. In this case, it was Alan Bible, the Democrat who won the election in November, and we held that there was a vacancy in nomination as well as the office there. Why shouldn't we follow the same procedure? And I realize the statute was adopted subsequent to that, but wouldn't that be the correct situation here?
You're exactly right, Your Honor. Since then, the legislature has created a new statute that is specifically designed to provide for candidate nominations in this particular type of special election. And that statute is 304-240. They also amended 304-040, which specifically says that candidates, when there's a vacancy in the House, must be nominated pursuant to the provisions of 304-200 to 304-250. And so the problem in the Georgetta case, which you're referring to, had to do with the vacancy was created after the primary, and there was no statutory procedure in place for nominating a candidate in that case. In this case, there is. There is a whole new specific statutory scheme to deal with nominations and how the election is conducted.
Is there a distinction then between a vacancy in office and a vacancy in nomination?
Yes, there is, Your Honor. A vacancy in the office will only create a vacancy in the nomination where there is no statutory or other procedure to fill that nomination. In this case, 304-240 clearly provides for nominations of major party candidates by stating that major party candidate is nominated by filing a declaration or acceptance of candidacy. In that case,
is it your position that but for Chapter 304's provisions, under laws it was written prior to 2003, if these facts had occurred, it would have defaulted to the central party nomination? Do you agree with that?
If it were exactly the same facts in terms of the person died after there was a primary and therefore there was no chance to hold a primary as it was in the Georgetta case. Clearly, those are not the same facts.
You're saying the 2003 legislation is entirely game-changing?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It was clearly, from the legislative history, it's clear that the legislature realized that there were no provisions at all to deal with this sort of situation. And so they created a whole new statutory process for doing that here. And that's what controls in this case.
Counsel, do we have a problem because there were no regulations adopted by the Secretary pursuant to 304-250?
No, we do not, Your Honor. First of all, as I mentioned in my brief, the Secretary of State, in his capacity as the Chief Elections Officer, has specific statutory authority to make interpretations of the election statutes. And in this case, that's what the Secretary did. Looking
at the interpretations, go back, use whatever interpretations happened a year before this election?
I'm not aware that there were any interpretations on this particular instance prior to the interpretation issued at issue in this case.
And there were never any regulations created going back to 2003?
Not to my knowledge, no. And in this case, as I mentioned, I don't think that's necessarily relevant because the Secretary does have authority to issue interpretations instead. And when you look at the statute, the language is absolutely clear. A major party candidate is nominated by filing a declaration of candidacy. There's not much more there to do in terms of writing regulations or interpretations. In fact, the Secretary's interpretation tracks the language of the statute almost verbatim.
So does that have the effect of reading out of 304 this language? A candidate must be nominated in the manner provided in Chapter 293 of NRS.
No, it does not, Your Honor, because as you'll note, that language is also expressly qualified by saying a candidate must be nominated in the manner provided by 293, except as otherwise provided in that subsection. That subsection meaning 304.240 sub 1. Under the Secretary's interpretation, minor party candidates and independent candidates are nominated in the manner provided by both statutes because 304.240 sub 1 does not provide all of the details necessary for those candidates to be nominated. For example, with independent candidates, it says you must file a petition of candidacy with the appropriate filing officer. But 304 does not tell you what form that petition has to take, how many signatures have to be on it, or who the appropriate filing officer is. And so it's necessary to turn then to the provisions of Chapter 293, which do provide those details. You need 100 signatures, and the appropriate filing officer is the clerk of the counties from which those signatures have come. It's not the Secretary of State. And so the Secretary's interpretation gives effect to all of those words of the statute by turning to 293, where, as it provides in the statute itself, it's necessary to do so, and it's not otherwise provided in 304.240.
Looking at other provisions in the Secretary's interpretation, he's referencing provisions in 293 that under 293.175 subparagraph 5A are specifically abrogated in any special election. What's the basis for relying on those statutes? I assume there are a bunch of typos in the statutory references in his interpretation. Otherwise, we'd be looking at criminal statutes. But assuming that he meant 293 for most of those other provisions, the fact of the matter is all of those primary election statutes, 295.175 all the way through 293.203, are abrogated.
Correct.
And what's the basis for pointing to those statutes when you're dealing with independents and minor parties?
The statute that we're looking at particularly is the one dealing with independents, which is within that range, 293.200, and there's two reasons for that. First, because 304.240, which controls the nominations, requires a petition of candidacy. That's the only statute that deals with that in 293, and therefore 304.240 itself invokes that statute. As you'll note in sub 2 of 304.240, it states that that Chapter 293 applies except as otherwise provided in 304. That's the first basis. The second basis is if we didn't look to that statute, there would be no process for having independent candidates run in this election. And obviously, for constitutional reasons, we have to let. And that's why we look to that statute for the guidance there. And so we're not picking and choosing statutes. All we're doing is we're picking those that are required by 304.240. For example, another statute that's in that range that is excluded is the statute that pertains to the filing fee. We're not charging a filing fee because, as you note, that's one of the excluded statutes. 304.240 is not contrary to that. Had it provided...
So, very pointedly, why did the district court get it wrong from your standpoint?
The district court got it wrong because its decision is directly contrary to the plain language of 304.240. That language says a major party candidate is nominated by filing. It doesn't say is nominated by the central committee, by the party, or by anybody else for that matter. It says you are nominated by filing a declaration or an acceptance of candidacy. The other thing with the district court's decision is it renders the entire third sentence of that statute completely meaningless. As this court has recently reiterated in Strickland versus Waymire, every part of a statute must have a job. Under the district court's ruling, the third sentence has no job at all, because the second sentence of 304.240 already requires every candidate to file a timely declaration or acceptance of candidacy.
Counsel.
Forces me to, I'm sorry, Justice Sadie, you tried to answer a question earlier. I'll withdraw.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. Counsel, notwithstanding the distinction in our statutory scheme, if we were to adopt your approach, aren't we standing then in a very small minority of three other states?
I am not certain, Your Honor, that we are that I assume you're referring to California and Hawaii, who have also held elections of this sort. I am not certain that that those are the only three states, and I would defer to Mr. Elias on that point.
And then a second question, unrelated, and so I apologize, but given your time situation, what, if any, sanction, or what is the effect then of the failure of either of the seated Secretary of States to adopt the regulation since the 2003 legislative enactment?
As I mentioned before, I don't think that the failure to adopt regulations is relevant in this case. Because
does it affect our standard of review?
I'm sorry, what?
Does it affect our standard of review?
No, Your Honor. It's a de novo standard of review because we're dealing with the statutory construction.
And what deference then do we give to the Secretary of State's position?
The Secretary of State's position is still entitled to deference because, as I mentioned, the Secretary has specific statutory authority to issue interpretations of law exactly so that he can effectively administer regulations. As you
so
know,
your point is that he was making a legal interpretation, not arriving at a policy determination?
That is correct. And as I mentioned, the interpretation tracks the language of the statute itself almost verbatim. And this court generally gives deference to agency interpretations of the statutes they administer when they are consistent with the statutory language and when they are not contrary to the legislative intent.
But you see it as purely interpretation-driven, not policy-driven.
That is correct, Your Honor. And I see that I am out of time, and I would like to turn over what little I have left to Mr. Elias, if the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Elias would like to reserve that for rebuttal. Thank you.
Respondents, Nevada Republican Party, and David Buell. I understand you're splitting your argument?
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you for the entry of the order.
Good morning, Chief Justice Douglas, Justice of the Supreme Court. May it please the Court. My name is David O'Mara, and with my co-counsel, Rue Goodenow, we represent the respondents in this case, Mr. David Buell, and the Nevada Republican
Mr.
Party.
Mr. O'Mara, could I ask you this first? Maybe sure. I hate to jump in, but we've got an interest of time. Amplifying counsel's last point, why shouldn't we just let the Secretary of State make this decision and interpretation? Because otherwise we're going to have judges running these elections and setting the policy, which is not a good idea. Maybe it's better for the chief elected official of the state to make these decisions. What's your position on
right.
that?
Right. The appellants want to base most of their argument on the deference and that we should give the deference to the Secretary no matter what he says. But as Justice Hardesty was questioning him, here is a Secretary of State that uses statutes that have been already specifically made inapplicable by the statutes, and what the Secretary of State has done is he has brought those statutes in and said they're not supposed to be used in special elections like we have here today, but I'm going to go ahead and use them anyways. And that's improper, and that deference should never be given to where a Secretary of State uses statutory language that is specifically excluded. The language of 175.5 specifically says that the provisions of that statute and up into including NRS 293.200 are inapplicable for special elections. That means that all of the procedures in the underlining general primary election are no longer available, and therefore we go to a position where it becomes unreasonable for the Secretary of State to make such an interpretation by imposing on this election statutes that the legislature has specifically said are not applicable.
Mr. O'Mara, I'm conceding that the statute is ambiguous, the 304.240.
Right. I think if we had a thoughtful and consistent language statute. We could have came to the right conclusion as Judge Russell came to. But unfortunately, what happened was is the Secretary of State had brought in outside statutory in his interpretation. It's caused that confusion, and now we are in an ambiguous situation to where we have to look at the standard of what has happened in Nevada, the traditions that we've done in Nevada, and all of Nevada's election statutes to come to the conclusion of what the legislature
Let me repeat my question. Do you think that the specific statute itself is ambiguous?
Yes.
And having conceded that, what does that do to the deference due the Secretary of State argument, which is what Justice Gibbons just said? It's an ambiguous statute. The state Secretary of State's interpreted it. Why shouldn't we go along with what he says?
But that's unfortunately the wrong analysis in which we have here today with the Secretary of State. He didn't interpret it. What the Secretary of State has done is he has imposed legal provisions or requirements on certain individuals and has used instances to impose certain requirements of statutes that are not applicable. For
what
example,
effect does his failure and the failure of his predecessor to have adopted regulations as mandated have on the deference this court should give that interpretation?
I think that has a lot to do with the deference, because if there were regulations that were imposed, then we would have looked at those regulations of going through the proper regulatory scheme where there would be meetings in regards to allowing the public comment and things of that nature. But in the grand...
So if Secretary of State Miller had adopted regulations pursuant to normal regulation process, and those regulations specified that the election would be a ballot royale or free-for-all, you would say those regulations could be permitted by the language of the statute?
I would say that the deference would be a little bit more given by the courts in regards to that, but there are still other issues of looking at this statute, such as the constitutional issues that my co-counsel will address here shortly. Plus, it depends, because the statute is set up for a special election, so regulations are going to have to be made any time that we have a special election. For example, what happens if this was a catastrophe? Well, then the statute is then changed for a 90-day period. So all regulations are going to have to be changed, because we don't know when the governor is given his declaration to set any standards for when certain candidacy files need to be filed. We don't know when central committees are going to have to meet and make sure that they designated their candidate so that candidate can be put onto the ballot. It changes no matter what the election will be in regards to...
Well, Mr. O'Meara, I'm not sure that fluidity is contemplated by the election statutes. NRS 293-247 says that regulations in effect as of December 31st govern the election that occurs in the succeeding year. There are no regulations. What is of concern to me, and is a broader legal question, is the extent to which deference should be given by this court or any court to an administrative decision which is not represented by regulations.
And I think that probably goes to the court's findings in other cases where there has to be a reasonable interpretation. Not only that, but the court has also found that if it is a question of statutory construction, the court does not have to give any deference to the agency. I also think that deference is usually given in regards to when the agency has given a regulation or has given its interpretation, and people have relied upon that interpretation, and then are going back and questioning it after that interpretation has been effective for some time. And this is not one of those cases, because it has never been in effect. It came out even before a special election was even called.
Could I ask a question, Mr. O'Meara? Justice Jerry at the RJC, walk me through this language. A candidate of a major political party is nominated by filing a declaration or acceptance of candidacy. That seems to me that anybody can file. Walk me through to get to your result, to get to Judge Russell's result.
Right. Okay.
On that portion.
If we look at Judge Russell, we look at him looking at the language of what he says is a candidate of a major party. Now, it says a candidate. It does not say candidates, which is plural, making it would be multiple candidates, and it doesn't say any member of a political party may be nominated. And so what Judge Russell shows is that something must happen. a designation of that candidate by the major party must occur so that that person can be nominated in this effect. So that is a reading of it. If we actually take the literal meaning of that statute, that one sentence which the Secretary has relied upon solely for its interpretation, it says a candidate. That would mean that there would be an interpretation that says that only one candidate who files the nomination papers would be the candidate of that major party. That would be the first person that filed the candidacy paper. And now, I don't think anybody's going to argue that that's reasonable. But if we look at the plain meaning of that statute, then that's the result that we would get. That's why we have to look at all the other qualifying statements, such as Justice Hardesty's talked about, where it says that the nomination must be pursuant to Chapter 293 of Nevada Revised Statutes, and that person must file a declaration or a candidacy. And what also is important to remember is that under subsection 2 is that it says that the general election statutes are applicable as well in a special election, which means that we still have to find a way of, once the person is nominated, of putting that person or placing that name or candidate on the ballot, which is one of the things that the Secretary of State has failed to do. And its interpretation has ignored in the fact that under the fourth and fifth sentence, it says a candidate is placed on the ballot. Well, there's no reference of how that person is nominated. And what happens when that happens? In the minor parties, what happens is there is no nomination process. So there is a vacancy for that. Therefore, the minor parties get to go to 293-165, just as the major parties will go to designate their candidate in regards to who's going to be on the ballot. So when we look at that, we have to look at what the Secretary of State has done in regards to deference. He looks at lines 5 and 6, which have to deal with minor parties as well as the independents, and he imposes on those individuals certain statutes that are not applicable because he says he has to fill in the blanks. Well, look, we may have to fill in the blanks for what is a candidacy or what is a declaration. There is no statement of what that is. So why don't we go back and look at what a candidacy document looks like. And you look at that document, and I believe it's in the appendix at 194 or 145, and it talks about the language of I will accept the nominee of my party if I am elected at the election. So that person is just the same way that if we follow the general election statutes, that person will accept the candidacy of his party when he is designated under 293-165. The statute in regards to 293-260 shows that we only allow, and Nevada's public policy has always been, that we are going to narrow the candidates who are going to be placed on the general election. Now, we can call this a special election, but the statute specifically says that we are going to treat it and have all the laws of Nevada's general election apply. Now, the Secretary of State has argued that 293-260 is not applicable because there's no language that says it's a special election. Well, there doesn't need to be any language that a special election, because 304-240 says general election statutes apply. And what does that require? It says that if there is a multi-party candidate, for example, here we have a Democrat and a Republican, only one of those candidates is placed on the ballot. Just as in the minor parties under their statutory scheme, which is applied in part by the Secretary of State, in regards to making sure that they get a candidate, also says that only one of their candidates is also placed on the ballot.
Mr. O'Meara, given your argument, I'm surprised by your concession at ambiguity. Why wouldn't the court view this statute as retaining the same symmetry that exists within the election statutes, a symmetry that provides for a nomination process in normal elections through the use of a primary, which results in a person becoming the candidate of the party on the ballot? And in this case, the statute specifically provides a candidate must be nominated in the manner provided in Chapter 293. Now, I've reviewed the entirety of 293 and 304 and all the other statutes associated with this, and the only statute that I can find that deals with nomination is 293-165. And that is not abrogated by any provision in 304 or in 293-175-5A dealing with special elections. Why wouldn't the same symmetry that exists in the normal election process exist here, with the exception that there's no primary, thus the parties nominate.
And I think that's a correct analysis, Your Honor.
And why would you concede that it's ambiguous? If it's ambiguous, where's the ambiguity?
Well, I think that the ambiguous has been created by the interpretation of the Secretary of State, who has imposed all of these statutes, and it therefore has caused this ambiguity for people to understand what the statute says. If we look at the statute, you're correct. In fact, if you read the Democratic Party's reply brief on page 9, they actually say we want to follow the same general election standard structure, which is exactly what you have just stated, which is a nomination process, and we follow 293 under 165, and then we file the same documents. When Justice Pickering asked ambiguity, that's where I'm getting the ambiguity for, and that's why we believe that because of the Secretary of State's interpretation, he has made this an ambiguity in a more chaotic situation that allows or that will require, in order to properly set forth an argument or a decision by the court, as Judge Russell did, to show that there was some confusion in regards to how the Chapter 293 and 304 work together, and therefore we need to make sure that all of the statutes work together, that we don't make any of them superfluous. And I think that you're correct in finding that the third sentence does not abrogate 293-165, and neither does 293-260 in the statutes. And I think that is what our argument is. Unfortunately, because of the improper interpretation by the Secretary of State, it has caused the ambiguity to occur.
Are you or Mr. Goodenow going to address the constitutional implications for the political parties if the Secretary's interpretation is sustained?
Right. And Mr. Goodenow will address that with the remaining minute that we have, Your Honor.
Counsel, before you sit down, just one question, because it was brought up in the briefs, and a distinction between the statute that says a candidate of a major political party versus a member of a major political party. Is there a distinction that we should look at?
I think that there is a distinction in regards to a candidate, because it implies, or it specifically says, that there is a candidate of a major political party, which that candidate is chosen under 293-165.
Well, a candidate seems to imply a lot of different things, because these days we have people that are part of a party but yet not part of a party, and they decide to be part of a sub-party, and they're a candidate, they're not a member.
Right.
So what do we have?
Well, I think that if we listen to Justice Hardesty in regards to the process, if we understand the actual process in regards to what happens, is that we look at the situation, and that person becomes a candidate of a major party once they're designated by the party members and placed on the general election ballot. And so there could be a member, and that person is not actually running, whereas a candidate is actually on the ballot, is a member of that political party, and also running for that office. Your Honor, if I could ask for an additional minute to answer Justice Hardesty's question for Mr. Goodenow.
Go ahead. Mr. Goodenow, we'll give you 3 minutes because we've chewed up a bunch of time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the court's indulgence. I want to go first to the constitutional issue. Justice Hardesty asked for our reading, and I think the essence of the problem is identified by your question, Justice Douglas. Almost all the cases that have been cited in the moving papers with respect to the constitutional issues are challenges to a law governing the method of selection of a party's candidates by primary system. Here we have selection of a party's nominee by self-nomination that has been substituted for the normal primary system that would apply in Nevada. Getting back to Justice Gibbons' question, this is the system that was adopted, and to Justice Pickering's question, the system that would apply in the absence of the Secretary of State's incorrect interpretation of Chapter 304. The primary nomination was designed to avoid the party convention method of nomination and the perception of corruption through control of party leadership over that process. NRS 304.240, as the Secretary of State interprets it, substitutes a new process in which the party voters have no role in the process of choosing the party's own nominee. While these cases that are cited in the briefs hold that a state may require the parties to use a primary to nominate their candidates, none of them say that party candidates may self-nominate. Appellants confused this challenge with a nonpartisan blanket primary like the court considered in the Grange cases, Grange 1 and Grange 2. There is nothing nonpartisan about the special election at issue in this case, and there is no primary. Here, neither the party's leadership nor the party's voters determine the party's own candidate under the Secretary of State's interpretation. Appellants argue that the Supreme Court of the United States rejected our claims when it held in Grange 1 and 2 that there is no right of a political party to have its nominees designated as such on the ballot. But this is not Grange, and Grange did not say that it's okay to list someone as the party's nominee on the ballot who isn't the party's nominee. Various other cases apply, but I'd like to, and I could analyze them given sufficient time. They're analyzed in moving papers. I wanted to move back just quickly to the deference because my constitutional argument addresses somewhat the deference question. There is no deference accorded to the agency interpretation when a matter of constitutional law is at stake. And that is the, I think, the governing principle which should govern the court's decision in this case. To get back to Justice Hardesty's point concerning the interpretation of the statute, I think that the statute, it can be, 304, 240, can be interpreted in a manner that is constitutional and is flows consistently with Chapter 293. In that sense, it is not an ambiguous statute. It would be perfectly consistent with Chapter 293. The trouble is the Secretary of State has introduced ambiguity in its interpretation. That's my point.
Before you sit down, would you like to weigh in on how we should read Brown versus Georgetta?
How we should read Rao versus...
How this court should look at that in light of this matter, the Brown case.
The McCarran case, you know.
I'm sorry, Georgetta case. I think that Brown versus Georgetta it stands as controlling precedent for the court's decision in this case. I think the court should also read the other cases cited in construing the decision-making process that throughout Nevada's history has been used to determine whether one candidate or multiple candidates can be placed on a party's ticket in a particular race, where the court has discussed and evaluated that decision-making process. The statutes and our history simply have provided that it is a one candidate per party nomination process, and that's how the court should read Brown versus Georgetta. It's controlling as to the historical process that should be used in the absence of any statutory guidance.
Any additional questions at this time? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Mark Elias, and I am here on behalf of the Nevada State Democratic Party. I first want to thank the court both for allowing me to appear pro hoc vici and also for taking this matter up on an expedited schedule. I realize these election cases tend to come up. They come up quickly, and they consume valuable court time and energies. I want to begin, and I'm going to try not to duplicate. I'm going to try to be very brief. I want to begin where I think I heard the discussions with counsel around Brown and deference. And in some respects, Brown is a perfect jumping point into the topic of deference because Brown represents what happens when the process fails. The process of filling vacancies is in its first instance a legislative process. Those laws are then interpreted and implemented by the executive branch. And it is only when those laws fail, where there is a death in very close proximity to an election, whether it was the Senate situation in Nevada, or whether it was Senator Wellstone in Minnesota, or whether it was Governor Carnahan, who was a Senate candidate in Missouri. You have very unusual circumstances where the laws simply don't speak to them. and the courts have to jump in. You're compelled, you're pulled into the case. This is decidedly not that case. The Nevada legislature has spoken to this situation. It has spoken plainly, and if there is ambiguity, it has also spoken as to how that ambiguity is to be resolved by determining that there shall be a chief elections official, that chief election official shall be the Secretary of State, and that independent of the rulemaking authority, that chief election official shall have interpretive authority and shall have the authority to, quote, provide interpretations and take other actions necessary for the effective administration of the statutes and regulations governing the conduct of primary, general, special, and district elections in this state.
What impact does the default from 2003 to 2011 in adopting regulations have on our standard of review? The statute quite clearly, 304, says the Secretary of State shall pass regulations. That's specific to 304. 293 has a similar mandate. It says he shall pass or she shall pass regulations. Those regulations were not passed. Why does that not create the gap that you're describing?
Because
in the legislative scheme?
For two reasons, Your Honor. Number one, because, in fact, the statute speaks plainly and clearly to how a major party candidate is nominated. So that's one answer. The second answer is that though it no doubt would have been preferable for all involved, and indeed we might not be here today had there been regulations promulgated, it does not abrogate the unusual power given to the Secretary of State to also interpret the statute. And I would point that it is not only found in law, this power, but in the proclamation from the governor calling this special election, he cited to the fact that there would be interpretations by the Secretary of State. And Your Honors, if I may be so bold as to say, an election system cannot run without the Secretary of State or whoever the chief election official is in that jurisdiction having the ability to fill in the gaps, whether they do it by regulation in the ideal case or whether they do it on the phone on election day to county clerks. If you don't
give on that point, counsel, this court in 1963 rejected the notion that a Secretary of State can operate election processes by telephone and oral communications and informal interpretations. I believe that 293-247 has a purpose. That statute quite plainly says you operate the election in accordance with regulations that are in effect on or before December 31 of the year immediately preceding a primary, so that everybody who's involved in the election process knows what's going to happen. It's not a fluid elective process determined by an elected official that just issues phone or letter responses to inquiries. I don't think we could have a system like that. You're not advocating that, are you?
May I respond?
Yes, go ahead.
My time is run. Thank you. I'll be brief, however. I'm not suggesting an ad hoc system. I am, however, though, suggesting that very oftentimes in the area of election administration, legislatures pass statutes and they don't get fleshed out as well as they should, in part because, frankly, special elections don't come up very often. And there's a lot of other regulations that have to be dealt with and other circumstances that have to be dealt with around election administration. It's not ideal, but it is the facts. And the law recognizes that beyond the power to promulgate regulations is the power to interpret the statute. And I'm not suggesting an ad hoc system, and perhaps I was too glib by suggesting on the phone, but my point is that the chief election official has to have the breadth of responsibility and authority to make this.
Let's credit your argument that the statute permits the Secretary. Where in the statement or in the interpretive section of the Secretary's interpretation here, is there an interpretation? When I look at interpretation number 112801, the only thing I see on this subject is subparagraph 2, which I think reasonable people could disagree as to whether that constitutes an interpretation or is simply a declaration. Is there any other interpretation or analysis of the statute as to the reason why the secretary arrived at this particular position?
Well, again, with indulgence from the court on time, our position is in the first instance the statute is clear. So to the extent the secretary is restating what we believe to be the statute in its clarity, then there may appear to be a...
So that's not an interpretation. You would argue that the Secretary of State's statement in paragraph 2 is a statement of a clear and unambiguous statute.
Your Honor, a statute that is plain on its face is not subject to interpretation. Interpretation comes in as counsel conceded to one of the questions.
But if this is an interpretation, wouldn't the secretary at least have to articulate the nature of the ambiguity and why or the reason for the interpretation provided so that that could be then tested?
Your Honor, I think in the case of the exigencies of a special election to fill a vacancy, I think the process that the secretary went through in this case was reasonable, and I don't think required more than that. Unless there are further questions.
Before you sit down, Justice Pickering, did you have a question?
I would like to hear your comments in response to the constitutional argument that was, we gave that extra time to address. Could he have a minute or two to do that?
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. In short, there is no constitutional infirmity here. Below, the issue of the constitutional question arose by suggestion by respondents' counsel initially that the case law, the existing Supreme Court case law, controlled that in fact there was an infirmity. After some rounds of briefing now back and forth, his position seems to have migrated to, well, in fact, those cases don't in fact create a constitutional problem, but they also don't prove that the statute is constitutional. Well, of course, we presume the statute is constitutional unless there is some reason to believe otherwise in the existing case law, it's not. And if you look at the interplay of, I think, the two most relevant decisions here, which is Jones on the one hand and Grange on the other, it illustrates where the Supreme Court of the United States is on this issue. Because indeed, what you see is that Justice Scalia, who wrote the majority opinion in Jones, loses that majority in Grange over the question I think is most insightful here. If you look at the Grange opinion at 552 U.S. 442, the Supreme Court said, California's blanket primary, we conclude, severely burdened the party's freedom of association because it forced them to allow non-members to participate in selecting the party's nominees. That's what was motivating the majority in Jones, and it's what Grange, to the extent it needed clarification, clarified, which is that what they were trying to prevent is a situation in which Democrats are able to participate in the primary election or otherwise shape who the Republican nominee is or vice versa.
What about the associational issue, though? A candidate is self-declaring him or herself to be the party nominee.
There is no case law, none. In fact, there's contrary case law from the Ninth Circuit to suggest that parties have a right to not associate with candidates they don't like. In fact, it is quite the opposite what the court found in Jones and Grange, which was the right is of the parties not to be burdened with voters selecting their candidates. So it's to use the term the Ninth Circuit used, it's not my term, it's not my favorite term, but it illustrates it. It's a right of parties not to be associated with undesired voters, not undesired candidates. So with that, unless there's further questions.
Just to say it as an initial question.
I have a clarification question that goes to the suggestion made by the respondents that it was, in fact, the Secretary of State's interpretation that made the statute ambiguous. I presume that you disagree with that wholeheartedly.
Your Honor, not only do I disagree with it wholeheartedly, I'm not, in all candor, sure I know what it means. The statute is either plain on its or it's not. If it's plain on its face, then it's plain on its face. If it's not, then it is ambiguous. And it is subject then to the questions that of whether or not the Secretary of State gets reasonable room and deference to interpret it. Thank you.
Counsel, before you sit down, one last question, and that goes to the heart of the matter. We're not the Secretary of State. We're not the legislature. Why did the district court get it wrong very succinctly?
The
The district court got it wrong for precisely that reason, which is that this is a statute passed by the legislature, it is administered by the Secretary of State, and the courts ought to take the judicially modest approach of standing back and letting the political branches, the executive branch and the legislative branch, pass and implement these laws. And where you have a statute that is plain on its face or subject to interpretation, you ought to allow the Secretary of State as the chief election official to interpret that statute.
Well, that may be true, but courts, with all due respect, and as a lawyer, you know this, courts are called upon every single day to interpret statutes. Statutes perceived to be ambiguous, statutes that are incomplete, statutes that require resort to legislative history. How is this any different? This is a statute over which, obviously, there's some level of disagreement. There's a lot of folks arguing different positions. Isn't that the role of a court, to interpret the statute when parties cannot agree?
It most decidedly is, Your Honor, and I wasn't trying to suggest otherwise.
Okay.
However, I think, though, that what courts typically will do is they will look in the first instance to what has the legislature said, what has the executive branch said, and that was my only point.
Well, what's interesting to me, both parties seem to acknowledge that the legislative history on this statute is void.
Fair enough, Your Honor. Thank you.
We can't look to the legislature.
Well, you can look to the words they passed, if not the intent.
Yeah.
If not the intent.
Thank you.
Anything else? Appreciate the arguments this morning, attempting to shed light on the matter before us. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you very much.